Welcome to the Seen Gene Podcast. The Seen Gene Podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Today's episode was originally published on the Halal Metropolis podcast. Let's dive into the episode.
Our guest today is Hajar Baban, the 2017 Detroit Youth Poet Laureate. I'm your host, Sally Howell, Halal Metropolis curator and director of the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. How are you today, Hajar?
I'm well.
So first, I'm going to start by reading your bio. Hajar Baban is the author of the chapbooks Relative to Blood and What I Know of the Mountains, winner of the 2018 Rick Campbell Chapbook Prize. A Pakistani-born Afghan Kurdish poet, she is a Daisy and Paul Soros Fellow working towards an MFA in poetry at the University of Virginia. She served as the 2017 Detroit Youth Poet Laureate and has received the numerous awards for her work and been named a Best New Poet, Best of the Net, and a Pushcart Prize nominee. She's also the sister of Halal Metropolis project manager, Asma Baban. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the show.
Thank you.
So first, I want to ask you about your experiences with the Inside Out Literary Arts program that you participated in when you were in high school.
I was in high school, and I didn't have any like creative writing classes at the high school that I went to. Shout out Fortson. So I was like just searching poetry events in the area, and all of them happened to be in Detroit. And I went to a poetry slam, like participated, and found Inside Out Literary Arts there. And then every Wednesday, I would like participate in their workshops. I think that was like really foundational for like even going to college for poetry.
Really?
Yeah. There was a, I guess, like flagship program called Citywide Poets. And so that was like a part of Inside Out. And they would have like, it was an after school program where students like from around the area could come and workshop their poems with like a mentor. That was in the Detroit Public Library, I think. So we would just like go to the basement, read poems, write poems.
And who was your mentor?
Nandi Comer, who's a poet, I believe, still living in Detroit, and whose work everyone should check out. They're a great writer.
Great. Well, I'll definitely check their work out. I was just interested in this because we were also interviewing Elise Alusi, who was one of like the project managers for Inside Out. And I know that it's really been influential in the lives of a lot of young people in the city. Mm. So I'm going to read a quote to you from another poet, Hayan Sharara, who grew up in Detroit. He says that your poems reveal a heightened awareness of life's blunt force traumas and an awareness of its more subtle, nearly invisible traces. Out of this condition of life, empire, tragedy, these poems create a space of refuge and of healing, and they accomplish this task with originality and depth. I couldn't agree with this more. So tell us how you do this. Tell us what the process is for you, how you bring all this material into your poetry.
I don't really know how to answer that question. I think that like the subtleties or what I'm hearing from in that quote, like what's underneath the surface, show up because as a writer, I think that I want to capture something that is hidden or that is unspoken. I think, and you've mentioned this, like a lot of my poetry has to do with language and not knowing. There's a lot of question about knowledge and I think what's hidden in my work, what can be said and what can't be said. I think also that.
I think that's, I mean, it's very clear. So one reason that I relate to your poetry so strongly is because I work in Dearborn, and I work with a lot of the students on our campus are You know, they're the children of Iraqi refugees who came after the recent war, or the, you know, who came in the 90s, whose families came in the 90s. Or we have a lot of Yemeni families who have been impacted by war. And even in the 80s and the 90s, a lot of the Lebanese families were here because of war. And I mean, I hear people, you know, describe their families. And how does your generation deal with the pain that your parents' generation went through? What led to these migrations? And I think that, you know, when our project is looking at Muslim visibility at Detroit, and I don't think that is very visible in general. So in our project, we interviewed a lot of visual, or in our exhibit, we included a lot of visual artists and to a certain extent musicians and things like this in our program, but we didn't include a lot of writers. And so I'm really excited to be talking to writers right now, and especially to you, because you bring to light a perspective or an experience of coming from a refugee household. And even in the, you know, in your description, when we talk about your family being, you know, Afghan, Kurdish, Iraqi, and you were born in Pakistan, or your family at least lived in Pakistan for some time. So that's a lot to to try and unpack. Yeah, and in her poetry, she writes so much about language. And, you know, your parents, I don't know how many languages they speak.
My mom and my dad are both fluent in Arabic, but my mother's first language is Dari. And my dad speaks Dari as well, and Kurdish. So they both have like a mix of languages. And,
so yeah. There's a lot of talk in your household that goes right past you, I'm assuming.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I wanted to ask you to read a poem, which really addresses this, sort of how the second generation maybe sees the first generation, or hears them or understands them. And there's humor in it, but it's not, the point of the poem is not that it be a humorous poem. So
this is written in the form called the Arabic, which was invented by Marwa Hillel, who's also a poet. My father can't say, after Marwa Hillel. I don't pray several times a day, but I do believe now my aim, my outbalanced look on my weaponed face, wrote a word in Arabic class with a cha, and the whole room looked, and my father said, no, not the word for superior, but everyone in my family know this trick, to give up the ghost.
So tell me more about this.
I think that growing up, I had a lot of questions about like the knowing, and we just spoke about like language, but knowing that my parents knew Arabic and that proximity to Arabic through religion. But I was largely confused about my dad's relationship to Arabic and his Kurdish identity. The cha is like a letter that is, you know, present in both Kurdish and Dari, but definitely not like present in most Arabic dialects. I know that like Iraqis do use it, but there's just that absence, that like question of what is in between these spaces and how I fit, not having really the language to speak Kurdish or understand what that means, the complexity of it, until like really recently in my later years. Yeah, I think that's where this poem was found out of. And using it in the Arabic form, I think, was important to convey that too.
Yeah, and the poem is written from right to left. So I think that's maybe what you mean by the Arabic form. So
yeah.
It's like when you see it on the page, that's why you start reading it. As an English speaker, you read it from left to right, and then you realize that it's actually written the other way. So it just... It like brings a for me, it brings like a smile of familiarity because of this, really this confusion that exists in a community that's bilingual with the languages always sort of working at, you know, across one another. So, yeah. So, I mean, and I think this also has something to do with the fact that, you know, you grew up in Dearborn, which is an Arab enclave. And so your family was a little bit, you know, different from the people around you. So, you know, so when you were in Arabic class, you know, if you were pronouncing a word differently from the Lebanese community, mm-hmm. you know, presumably the other students were mostly Lebanese, you know, this might have also made you feel a little bit of dissonance from the community that you were in. So tell me what it was like to grow up in Dearborn.
Oh, yeah. Weird, because I had felt that I would walk into a room and because I wore hijab that I had something that I didn't need to explain. But as I grew older, I knew that there was a lot that I couldn't explain even if I wanted to. Like, I couldn't get there. There was always a commonality of religion, but even the idea of Kurdistan, like, this, like, close to, like, Iraqis, for example, it didn't, like, translate. And then, like, knowing I speak this language and not having, like, Dari, for example, and not having any real roots or, like, proximity to anyone who would understand that, I think that dissonance is a great word to describe it. So I felt connected and also as if there was something not belonging.
I hear that a lot, again, from young people who grew up in Dearborn. There's also, I think that children of parents who are from two different sort of ethnic, ethno-national, religious, however you define things, backgrounds, often especially feel that, because they're, you know, especially in a place like Dearborn where the community is so big and so robust and so dynamic and so, you know, full of itself in a good way, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, just exuberant about itself and its freedom to be Arab in this American context, right? So there's a lot of, like, you know, pride in what it is, but there's also it also has its own hegemony, you mm-hmm. know. So I think for people who are, you know, who aren't, like, fully a part of the community, I hear Yemeni students saying that they feel, you know, like they're treated as outsiders in Dearborn, or Iraqi students say the same thing. So mm-hmm. I hear this a lot, or you know, children who have, like, an Anglo mother and a Lebanese father or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's, to me, it's very common. So I get a feeling in your poetry that one of the things, you know, back to this issue of language and back to the question of, like, what you're pointing to, that you're from this Dari speaking family, your mom's an Afghan, and yet you're in a community where, you know, until a few weeks ago, there weren't other Afghan families. Yeah. So in your poetry, you discuss this a lot, like the not knowing enough about the family's history, not being able to sort of pull this truth from your father in particular. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I think, well, I want to touch on one thing, like, because you do mention, like, my mother and, like, her identity. I think that I've thought about this less on the page and, like, more internally, like, as an artist and as a writer, questioning my mother's absence in my poems. And growing up, I had thought that language, specifically for Kurdish people, like a people without a nation and without, like, something, like, tangible or to hold on to, was the thing that keeps culture alive and continuing. And so I had felt for a long time that just simply knowing my mother's language felt like I had that much agency over not having to say, hey, I'm this thing. So I do want to say, like, as a sort of explanation, or as a, like, it's a working artist statement, that I still, like, really harp on this idea of language for my father, because it's missing. And that does take away a lot of agency of being considered, you know, Kurdish, or identifying with that identity. but I also want to say the difference between like being a refugee and an immigrant. Hearing you talk about like the Yemeni students and the Iraqi students that you've worked with, it really is different to know that like part of someone's story is that someone had to die or someone was killed or martyred. I think that I will always be really sensitive to that, and I will always want an answer, or even to just say that someone was there. So specifically with my dad, I think that I can't imagine that nothing was worth it in terms of like exploring that identity attached. Because if you know a Kurdish person, you know someone who has died because of their identity.
An Iraqi Kurd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is like, that's really deep to me.
No,
and that is, you know, kind of a backbone for writing, because underneath that is, you know, children and like people who survived and are trying to continue life.
So do you mind reading Alhamdulillah?
Yes, I can read it.
Okay. So
oh, when you emailed me, I was like, what poem is she talking about? I really was 17 when I wrote these.
Okay. So she was 17 years old when she wrote this poem, but I want you to read it against a very short poem, because it really illustrates the point that you just made.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so at 17, you were intimately aware of this idea at 17. This is not an idea that has come to you. This is something that has been a part of your writing from the beginning.
Yeah. And, you know, this wasn't supposed to be a poem at all. I thought, like, it could just be an epigraph to the book. But then the person editing was like, no, this should be, like, its own poem on a page. It's really short. Alhamdulillah. What a privilege it is just to have something and someone and somewhere to miss at all.
So this is differentiating you from your cousins, your imagined cousins who aren't here.
Hmm.
And it's very real. And I really take your point about the difference between a voluntary migrant and an involuntary migrant.
Mm-hmm.
There's no comparison between the experience. And I mean, I see a lot of young people in Dearborn, you know, they're aware of their parents' difference from, you know, other Americans. You know, their parents are immigrants, and there's always the generational clash. You know, the parents are maybe a little bit afraid of some parts of American culture, or, mm-hmm. you know, the parents have an accent or don't speak English at all, you know, and there's a lot of to write about there, but it's mm-hmm. very different from people who come here because they had to, because they were displaced. And also, I think so many of the people who are in Detroit today from the Middle East are here because of American wars, very specifically.
Yeah.
So it really adds a level of complexity to the situation. Well, so I want to change the subject a little bit. So our project is called Halal Metropolis, and I'm sure you're aware of it because of all the great work that Asma has done for us, your sister. But so we're really interested in and the visibility of the Muslim community of Detroit, and in the many ways in which it is really sort of transforming the culture of the city and the culture of the metro area, and really contributing to the future of the region in economic terms and cultural terms and political terms even. So I'm just wondering, you grew up here. But for the last 6 or 7 years, you've lived outside of Michigan. So I just wonder what your perspective is on this Halal Metropolis. Is it something distinctive, or is it does it just seem ordinary to you?
Oh, there's nothing ordinary about anything happening in Dearborn ever. So not ordinary is my short answer. I think it's really important. I think that hearing you talk about like visual artists that you're working with, but also like writers. There are so many artists in Dearborn. You know, being away has actually made me realize that. Being away from Inside Out and then seeing like that now they have involvement in Dearborn schools. Like, that is so important. So I think it's lovely. I think it's important work. And it's so great to hear that people are invested in that. And in Dearborn in that way. Because the people are here doing that work, and now we just have like a spotlight on them, which is really amazing.
I am interested in the fact that your poetry is so internal. You don't write really Dearborn, you know, you have a lot to say about Dearborn, but Dearborn isn't on the page very much. I'm sort of reading the context in which I'm reading that into your poetry. It's not something that is just on the page. I just wonder if that is in the future of your poetry, if that's something that you struggled with, or if it's just something that's not what you're interested in.
I think, well, first of all, I think that's an amazing question. And I think that place in my poetry is very fluid and moving. I think that I don't always situate my poems in a location. And I also think that there are moments where, like, Dearborn shows up in my work very explicitly. And I think that there are, like, that happens when it's central to the idea that I'm, like, touching on. And I don't know if it would be less difficult or more difficult to grapple with this mixed identity of being both Afghan and Kurdish anywhere else. I think that it was difficult in Dearborn, but I also think it was difficult when I was in a different country. And I think it was difficult when I was, you know, in the middle of Wisconsin. So I think that I don't, like, place is not, or location is not really something that I set a lot of my poems in, because the feeling that I'm going with has carried through different places and different locations. And I think that kind of has to come with, you know, being from different places as well. Mm-hmm.
I hear what you're saying. So really the focus of your poetry is very often on that identity construct that you're trying to grapple with. Mm-hmm. One, you have a poem in your first book, it's another one that I really appreciate, because I hear just so many resonances between it and the way I see other people in the community talking about what they appreciate about being in a place like Dearborn. Mm-hmm. And it's the poem called All I Have Are Houses. Can you tell me a little bit about what inspired that poem?
I think, like, moving away from a larger idea of home and like going in depth about each of the things sort of talked about in that poem, I can really see it as working sort of more of a foundation to those specific themes of, like, citizenship or death and loss and belonging. What anger and the sadness that's underneath anger that I'm allowed to express, or that are, you know, familiar to express and to find, like, a voice in.
Well, in your more recent poetry, I noticed that there are often in the text, there are these gaps, and it really, as a reader, it's kind of like frustrating, because you want the word to be there, you want the meaning to be there, but it's also exciting because you can fill in the blanks yourself as a reader, mm-hmm. and it brings you more actively into the poem as a reader, you know? Mm-hmm. So where did you come up with this practice? And what are in those gaps in your mind?
So there are, like, a lot of poets that I see, like, working with space on the page. I think when I was writing a lot of those poems, a poet that I was, like, heavily influenced by was Safi El-Hillo, who is, like, a Sudanese-American poet. And I think that what it allowed me to do was, one, not have to mention like these things that I also can't say, you know, whether that's protecting someone or whether that's not feeding into the idea that you have to say that thing, or that, you know, someone needs to read like the gruesome or the horrific to be able to understand or like be near to it. But I think there's also poems that I've written with space and Sejour that are words that I wish that I had, or answers that I wish that I had, but I don't. So a place that I can't really penetrate and come close to. So I think there's a poem, If My Father Gave Me the Words in His Language. You are in many ways more ready than other nations that freed themselves before from cruelty, after Qazi Muhammad. If my father gave me the words in his language, I am proud of my execution. No one had to see how my hung by above my head. Everyone in the new, at my young daughter, she, what they say when alone. If I let them, what happened to me, they might. In retreat, I could. The past, if I cover my with another life, I am enough to bring another country to this. Usually I wake to remind of the air, and then I am just my beating chest, my weeping headed toward a transfer, my body serving so many.
That's amazing. And it is, it's really a challenge to read. So you mentioned that you've been reading a lot of Safi al-Halu's work. And I wonder if you've also read very much Mojokov. Have you read her work? She's a Syrian-American poet.
No, I don't think so. How do you spell it?
Mojakahf. She's also a novelist. She wrote The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf.
No.
So her poetry is, she's a vivacious, vibrant, she's a great performer. You know, she's almost a comedian. I mean, mm-hmm. she has so much humor in her poetry. And her parents are Syrians who came here as engineers, but they were sort of proselytizing for Islam when they first came in the 70s. So she's very steeped in the Muslim community very specifically, but she writes sort of against people's stereotypes about Islam. And there's a lot of exploration of like sexuality and stuff like that in her work. But the reason I mentioned her to you is because she also writes as a Syrian, you know, the civil war in Syria just devastated her family. And so she's not a refugee, but the impact of the war and the way she thinks about the war and the way she sees the war, or when I heard you read the poem, it made me think about some of her writing about just the trauma of being here at a distance from things that seem to be so consequential. Tell me about your current work. Is there new stuff for us to look forward to?
Yeah, I have a few poems appearing in Mizna, Journal of Arab Art. And I'm currently still in grad school, so I will be working on a thesis soon. But the current project that I'm working on right now is this like Kurdish terror suspect in the U.S. His name was Yasin Arif, and he was like deported back to Kurdistan, and he came here like seeking refuge, and he was like accused of terrorism after 9/11 along with another Muslim man, and he was like imam at a mosque, and he wrote a book called Son of Mountain. So I've been writing poems after and about him, so that's what I'm currently working on.
Yeah, I see the mountains. Her most recent book is called What I Know of the Mountains. So tell me quickly, because I don't know enough about Kurdish history to really get the meaning of the mountains. I mean, I know that a lot of minority communities in that part of the world live in the mountains because they're like strongholds where mm-hmm. you can seek refuge if you're from a minority community. But tell me about the role of the mountain in your work, just in the larger sense.
So there's this like famous saying that a lot of Kurdish people use, but actually wasn't written by a Kurd. I think it was like a British historian. And there's like a lot of like talk about that being sort of like forced isolation on us. But the saying is the only like friends of the Kurds are the mountains, or like we have no friends but the mountains. And a lot of like Kurdish people, yes, they like have lived in mountains, and they've also like retreated to the mountains after like betrayal from like certain like countries and you know, as a place of refuge. I think that the idea of like a forced isolation or a promise of isolation is like really central to the idea that I work with when writing about Kurdish identity.
So what do you see as the future of the Halal metropolis?
I'm not sure. Anything they would like it to be, I would hope, you know?
Okay, well, so tell me about how you see your work contributing to this visibility that we're talking about, the visibility of the Muslim community, the visibility of the Kurdish community, the visibility of the Afghan community. I think the thing I see is that you're really highlighting the diversity of the Muslim community. I don't think most Americans and even most Muslims have an understanding of exactly how diverse the Muslim community is. But what do you see your work is? How are you contributing to the visibility of this population?
I'm hoping to bring visibility to anyone who sits with like silence for too long. And whether that's like intentional or whether that's because they don't have words to put to their feeling or their questioning. I think a lot of people's view of Islam is really rigid, whether they're practicing it themselves or whether they're like finding it as an outsider. And I think that, yeah, I'm hoping to bring visibility to those who have a lot of questions and a lot of silence in their exploration of spirituality and God. The winter my family gets American citizenship. I hang from a performance athlete's weight during a school assembly. He lifts me as my entire class watches my wet pits stain the show. I didn't know that now, beyond the passport, new seasons. My father wore a sweater vest my mother knit him. Sometime after all this, I researched the country printed under my name. I shocked the child in my throat, oh fear that remains unparalleled, though I've since reached ages that signal more worry, 22 and unmarried, useless, but not like the lonely mother, her hands, after many children, break her skin dry more than she knows. No city of snow, no mountains, justify the isolation, troubled history to look back on with no promise, after her, in the future. Those are my genetics, consistent dull, what will live in my brain forever for the time that I stand in front of everyone in the room, American flag hanging beside as the people praise one hand under God. And this next poem was originally published in Bahar magazine. And I wrote it last year when my mom was like really, really set on going back to Afghanistan. Forgiveness. For so long after, I could only fall asleep in rooms without windows, beyond the sun or the sounds overhead. It could have been a wet wash from God or the plumbing. In the dark, I can hear, past the padding, my mother speaking of returning to Kabul and my sister not wanting to blame her. It could happen in a hotel or a restaurant, and then she'd be asking for it. But here, who knows if she will find herself a friend again, in a car away from the village, maybe one among several others. I'm afraid it's true, Mother, once you felt scarce inside, that heavy hollow, there is no more rest. You can only be willing for danger, awake all night, a reincarnate, trading thin layers of metal for a lesson to your daughter.
Today's episode was hosted by Sally Howell. It was produced by Muhammad Jafar and Esma Baban and edited by Muhammad Jafar. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish and our logo was created by Maisara Abdelhaq. Scene Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Scene Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Check out our website, scenejimpodcast.org, for more information on our guests and to view videos of their readings. Thank you for listening.